I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Creative Kale, a box set podcast spin-off. Marsha joins me. Now, you may know Marsha from our box set podcast, has joined us at various points in the past. She's just been off travelling the world and she's back now. And I really wanted to talk to Marsha because she lives in Canada now and she was in Britain. She lives there. And also just that... if it wasn't for Marsha, Jamie and I would never have got anywhere in radio, I don't think. And that's true of a lot of people. You were always very good at encouraging people, weren't you? And hello, Marsha.
Hi. I think we should tell the story of when we first met, because I was doing...
Remember it?
I remember it so well. I was in Manchester we were trying to get a license in Manchester for XFM before there was one. And so we were doing a 1 month broadcast, and you two had sent me, so I just had an email with an attachment and I just assumed it was a demo, and I quite like listening to people's demos and helping them, but I was like, oh, I'll get to that. And it took me days or weeks to get to it. And then when I listened, it wasn't a demo at all. It was just you two being like, hello, hi Marsh. Help us. And it was really funny, and I got you to send me a demo, and it was dreadful. The links were like 10 minutes long. I mean, it's dreadful if you're trying to get into commercial music radio, where you are often not allowed to speak for more than 30 seconds. But I could hear the magic, and so I feel like actually of everyone I've listened to, you guys have been the most extreme example of me being able to hear the magic among a lot of, like, oh my God, you've got a lot of work to do, but there's something very, very special
Jesus,
underneath.
Jesus, wow. Like, well, yeah. Here's my version of that story.
Oh yeah, I want to hear this.
I'd completely forgotten that we'd just sent you a recorded message saying, hi Marsha, we're Helen and Jamie, we want you to help us. I'd completely forgotten that. I thought we'd just emailed you, and then we waited about 6 months and then you emailed us back, and we sent you a demo after that. But no, wow, how inventive of us. Me, obviously, as if Jamie even wanted to pick up the email. And then Marsha met us. I was directing a play at Manchester Met Uni, and you came and sat in the radio studio there on Oxford Road with us and met us for the first time and gave us some notes on what I would remember as being just 100% supportive notes on our excellently edited tight demo. This is the first I've heard that maybe we went on a bit too much.
A little bit.
How interesting. I mean, I don't doubt it, but well done for not pointing that out, because the part of this Creative Kale expedition for me is learning about myself. I'm now in my 30s. I've quit the mainstream radio thing for now, and in various mid-30s crises of now looking back at it and going, and what one of those things, looking back and going, we were excellent, you know. It's kind of, I thought we were rubbish, and then I look back and I listen to a lot of stuff we did by accident. I come across like clips of things we did and I go, oh, that was brilliant. How can you
were brilliant.
Think so
you
bad?
Were brilliant. I mean, you both still are, but yeah, you were an incredible radio presenter.
But this is the thanks. This is the flip of that, which is also, no, you also, like, well, you needed to learn a lot. Like, there was a lot to learn as well, which is nice. So it's, yeah, it's good to hear that we weren't, it's good to hear that it's not just this, like, there's a period of my life where I had a heyday followed by massive self-doubt. It was like, no, actually, we were learning all along. And Yeah.
I also think there's no such thing as a heyday. And I think as creative people, especially if you've done something very shiny, you know, there was a point with me in radio where there was actually several points with me in radio where everyone was like, oh my God, Marsh, you're the next big thing. Like you're this. And I was doing demos for this giant radio station and that one. And, but actually I've now ended up doing, which we should explain what it is, but I've now ended up doing this job that it wasn't just that I never thought I would do this job. It's that you could have given me like 10 million hours and endless pencils and pieces of paper and asked me to write down every job that exists in the world. And I never would have written this one down because I never would have crossed my mind. And, so I teach people how to tell stories. I teach people how to tell true stories. And so most of my work is spent just sitting, asking people to tell me these totally fascinating stories. And I get to like learn about, like I know now from the inside what it's like to have a brain tumor and have it taken out of your brain in a brain operation. I know what it's like to run into a black bear and then spend the next hour lying on, you know, panicked on the ground while it snuffles and licks you. I know what it's like so many, all, you know, I know what it's like to work in corporate mining and go to a diamond mine and have to be strip searched afterwards. And one of many things that makes me obsessed with storytelling is that when we hear stories, our brain responds as if we're inside the story. Like our brain, like if you, if someone tells you about something they smell, your olfactory system lights up. You know, if they tell you about gripping a pencil, your motor part. So my brain has like genuinely, when I say I know how it feels, like I'm going through that experience with people. And also because I'm trying to story coach them, I'm getting all of the details out. So I'm really, anyway. And so my point is, I love my job now. And like when I was in radio, for so many years, I was like, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life. And it never, you know, I thought either I would make it or I'd fail. And it never occurred to me that there was a third option. And I think often as creative people, if we do something shiny and exciting, there is a tendency to be like, that was my heyday. Or, you know, I'm an artist and I had this exhibition that everyone loved. Or I'm a journalist and there was a point where I was getting loads of work. But actually, I think you can have all sorts of different kinds of heydays. And then also the thing which you're probably experiencing during your crisis, which is I want to have a nice time. And like, I miss a few things. I miss DJing to a room full of 2,000 or 5,000 people. That's an amazing thing that is like, hard to replicate in other areas. And I kind of miss I miss dancing in the radio studio, like having the music and something to do with the music. But mostly the way I feel about radio is it's like this super long-term relationship I was in. And I had a lot of really great times, really amazing times, and I had some terrible ones. But mostly it was like pretty good, but I felt slightly anxious all of the time. Yeah. And I feel really, you know, there's so much stuff, like the constant slightly niggling anxiety and the constant feeling of like, am I quite making it? Am I going to get fired? And for me, a big thing was having to stay on top of everything. Like, what's the latest album? Who's it by? What do I think about it? What do I think of it?
Yeah, you had to care about that kind of stuff. We didn't. Yeah. We would. We just had the playlist. You had to be somewhat of an expert, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know which direction we should take. There's so much we could talk about, and we only have a short amount of time. But I suppose, okay, so I had Lee Cockerill on, the ex-vice president of Walt Disney World Resorts. Now, you haven't had a chance to listen to that yet, I presume?
I haven't.
The reason, it almost ended my search for creative kale, the conversation, because what I was talking to was really quite intimidating in the sense that he's just very straightforward, like very straightforward guy, gives you an answer, waits for the next question kind of thing. It'd be a kind of very good, but he's from the business end, you know. We're not Walt Disney World Resorts is not making animations, obviously, but it is a huge show that's being put on. So anyone who's worked like we have as part of a big corporation making a user experience, making a customer-based experience, which is what you're doing when you're on the radio, I think we have a lot in common in terms of how to get the best out of people. And what he said was exactly what I think, just from a corporate point of view. So my whole belief that, like, where radio and where companies go wrong that are a business of entertainment is that they don't build in checks and balances to really listen to the people who are dealing with the customers. They don't build in the idea that a manager could be getting it wrong. You know, it's a very, in an industry like you were in with radio, and the same with actors, I think, and anything where there's a great supply and a small demand for the talented people, you can very easily have this situation where you've got that feeling of terror that you described, and the slight nerves throughout an entire career of trying to please the person above and not really being treated as an expert of what you do, which is what you were. Marsha was the best at what she did on the radio. And the idea that so what Lee Cockerell kind of said was the most interesting stuff for me was when I was saying, so how do bad managers get it so wrong? How do you get a bad manager in an industry like that? And he said, well, they're just born bad, and if it's bad at the top, it'll be bad all the way down. But also I was like, well, how do you spot in a massive corporation like Disney, how do you spot a bad manager? Like, if there's a manager at the park that's not doing what they should or whatever. And he said they have anonymous answer phones. All of the senior execs have anonymous answer phones. And you can call and tell on your manager and say what it is that they're doing and that it's wrong, and they'll investigate, and if that's true, that person will be gone. Everyone's got a part to play, and if you're damaging the product, the idea being that the product is everything, the user experience, if you like, is everything. Now the idea that in radio, that seems such an alien thing to me. A lot of my experience of radio from a company point of view is sell everything as quickly as possible, you know, rather than how can we make people stay with us for longer. And I think some groups, including a group that you worked with quite a lot, are starting to wake up to this now and are starting to say, okay, how do we've figured out what the kind of product is in terms of the easy access to it. How do we now make people listen for longer? How do we build relationships with the audience? And that's very interesting.
When I first started out, when I was doing student radio, the first kind of professional people that I came into contact with, other than the little station in Edinburgh that I started on, were people who worked for GWR, Great Western Radio, who kind of eventually merged with Capital and then became, you know, GCAP, the company that I worked for. But GWR were amazing that they put this huge, heavy onus on training, and they would sit down once a week with all of their DJs, and with them you would think that it was kind of soulless, in that for them, you know, they would have these 30-second links, which, if you don't know a link, if you're listening, like, a link is the talking bit between music. So it was a music radio station. You would have 30-second links. In that 30 seconds, you know, you would have to talk about this particular subject, and you would have to start and end with the tagline. But they were really into how can, with all of these parameters, how can we make it creative? And they would do demo crits once a week, and they would work, and they would have like training conferences for the DJs and for the people running the radio stations and all this stuff that kind of fell by the wayside. And so to me, I feel like they really, from the outset, they looked like this very corporate company, you know, unlike their competitors who would let people ramble on about whatever they wanted, but they actually really supported. And I felt like they really saw the value in the talent. I remember seeing one of these guys speak, because they used to do a lot of stuff with student radio when I was doing it. And I remember one of them saying, my breakfast show DJ, I would sell my house for him if I had to. Yeah. Like, they really appreciated that actually that was the DJs were the, like, that the talent were the things that were the most important. And
Of bosses that I speak to across the board, BBC to commercial, you know, the number of bosses who aren't fans of their breakfast shows or their shows is phenomenal. It's such a strange system. It feels so utilitarian. It feels like the presenters are a utility. They're like the coffee machine being drafted in. It's such a strange situation, and at the other end of the scale you have the this world where I went to watch Moana the other night.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, Marcia. It's amazing.
I've heard it is.
It's amazing. And all your activist tick boxes will be happy as well, yes. I imagine.
Yes, I've read about it.
There's no love story. The princess is kind of a princess, but she's not really a princess. She wants more for her life, but she also loves home. She's not just trying to escape. She also loves where she's from. And
awesome.
I mean, it's just... it's brilliant. The music's brilliant. It's just amazing. And you look at that, you look at the credits on that Disney animation now. Disney, you know, under the influence of John Lasseter from Pixar, I think, have become obsessive about story. So you look at, like, mm-hmm. Story By, and there's, like, 25 people employed to work on the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows how valued they see that, just like Netflix now. The amount of money they're putting into these series that we're talking about, from Stranger mm-hmm. Things to everything else, they are genuinely realizing that content is king. But I hate that phrase so much, because I've heard it used so much in radio, and it's bullshit. It's used in a way that means that means nothing. If you just say content is king,
mm-hmm.
and then you just make a cookie cutter version of something you think will work because you've reduced your audience to a demographic, okay, mm-hmm. Then it's not going to work. What Netflix and Disney and stuff are doing is going, content is king, therefore employ the best people who know about story, who know about all of these things, and genuinely make it great. You know, I think in radio they're still behind the curve with that. They're still kind of they're not necessarily drafting people. It's something someone said to me years ago, was like, what if Steven Spielberg came to your radio station and looked at how you plan for your show? How would it change, you know? And most people who work brilliant. In radio, they just don't know any better. Most people who work mm-hmm. in radio have only ever worked in commercial radio. If they were to get in storytellers, people like you, people who know about story and writers and stuff, to ask the questions, how do you really find story? How do you really structure it? How do you, you know, what is this thing? Then maybe they'd help themselves. But I'm not here to rant about radio. I am here... I'm really not.
Can I just really quickly say on that yeah. there are few people, and they're not yet in the big mainstream, but who are bucking that and doing that kind of thing. And if you don't already know Matt Deegan, I'm going to try and get you to get him on this podcast, because he'd be so good. He runs Fun Kids Radio, which is a kids radio station. And he's from GWR background. I mean, we did student radio together, and we both kind of came up through that GWR being trained era. And and he just has a lot of very interesting ideas. He's just, oh my God, he's one of these people I want to plug my brain into his brain and just upload everything, because he's so interesting and really thinks about all of these. But he does such interesting things with Fun Kids on air and off air as well, kind of looking at their YouTube channel and being like, well, what can we do and how can we engage people? And he really nurtures the talent. And one of the things that I think he does, which is really a beautiful thing, is he understands no one in radio is going, oh, it's my dream to work on Fun Kids Radio. You know, for them, it's a stepping stone. But he's not like, oh, you're going to leave us anyway. He's like, I'm going to nurture you as much as I possibly can, and then let you go. And yeah. then we'll...
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely... There's loads of people I've met who think, whose brains are in the right place. There's some brilliant people working in radio, otherwise I wouldn't have worked there for so long. But that said, institutionally, I think it's not a place that... The way that it's incorporated business in its entertainment seems to damage it more than help it, and it should help it. So they're not... It's not like Disney are asking this question as well, but Disney in the case of Moana, or Netflix in the case of all the things that they're doing, they are starting with the question of who do we need to employ and how can we make it attractive for them to work with us
mm-hmm.
to get success.
Right? Yeah.
I feel like what institutionally, what radio across the board thinks when it thinks about business is that it goes, how little can we pay people and how few people can we employ?
It's so true.
Isn't it?
So and
it's
true.
It's like, I totally understand the idea of a basic business sense of, you know, keep your overheads low. But at the same time, it's such an institutional thing to go, how much can we rip people off? How little can we get away with, you know? I'm sure I saw a piece of research once that was like, how few songs can we get away with before an audience isn't happy with
right.
the number of songs? So how
yeah.
small can your A-list be before people really start to get annoyed? And it's that kind of... it's almost like we're still very young in thinking about how to work business. And
and I think the problem is in terms of how they treat the staff, and I think you're right, is that it is this thing where so many people want to do that. You know, so many people want to work in radio. And also a lot of people don't understand that it's not like the 80s where radio stars live in giant mansions. Like, they don't understand that you're getting paid a pittance. And there's so many with any job, same with acting, same with singing, you know, how so many more people want to do it than there are spaces for them to do it, that it's very easy for the people in charge to treat people.
Yeah, and I think as well, you know, to be kind to the people in charge, who many of whom are friends, I think a lot of people have to, because it's quite a cruel, it's quite a cutthroat business thing. I think there's this culture that where people have to pretend that they have all the answers. So they're often answering to a guy who has all the money at the top, you know, somebody who's funding this venture. They're all private companies now. And if you're going to get a job with them, you have to sit there in an interview and say, I know all the answers here and I'm going to get you listening figures. You know? And they go, yeah, fine. Which is really damaging, because sometimes they come up with great theories, or they'll hear people like us talking and they'll go, what we need to do is really make content king. And then they don't know what that means or how to apply it. And if they had the ability to sit there and say, we don't know enough about story, let's find out about it, that would be a great place to start. But they don't, because everyone needs to try and keep hold of their own bloody jobs. And so what you find if you're employed at pretty much any radio station, I've never, you know, you've got to watch what you say and who you say it to, because there's a pyramid there that you need to keep people happy, otherwise you're out, you know.
Yeah.
And you get people like Jamie, who Jamie is a brilliant personality on the radio. He's
brilliant,
and he's so interesting to listen to compared to me and you, I think.
Right.
His personality type is one that it draws people in, because he doesn't want to be loved. He doesn't care. Yes. You know. And yet,
so funny.
But everybody on the radio sounds like us, because we're the ones who will do the networking, the schmoozing, send the emails, all of that. And we please that boss, that pyramid structure. Someone like Jamie would never have got anywhere if it wasn't for me going, come on, get your arse in gear. And making excuses for him, leaving meetings early or whatever. And yet, he's the most valuable thing. So there's a really good example of where the business of entertainment can be spoilt by choice, and they just listen to the people who shout the loudest instead of going out there and going, who can we get that listeners will really identify with? People in Chorley will identify with Jamie and his point of view much more than they'll identify with me and my point of view. So activism, you've become quite a strong activist.
It's so funny, because in my world I'm a very weak, small, simple armchair activist, but it's more, I feel like I have one foot in maybe a few toes in activism camp, and then the other foot in what some of my activist friends call straight world.
What do you think changes the world of entertainment when it comes to things like Moana being an all-female, a mostly female cast, and not now having to be a princess with a love interest. What do you think changes
and
it
and
more?
And on top of that, they got Taika Waititi in to write, who's the guy you know from making What We Do in the Shadows. What We Do in the Shadows, yeah. Last year, and he made Boy, and he did a film this year called Hunt for the Wilder People. If you haven't seen What We Do in the Shadows, it's a mock documentary about three vampires living together in New Zealand. It is one of the funniest films I have ever seen in my entire life. I've watched it four times and it makes me like cry with laughter every time. Anyway, they got him because he's Polynesian, and so he you know, he presumably is part of the reason why it's so brilliant, but also to make sure they just were a lot more culturally sensitive than they traditionally are with this film.
But my question is, it's all interesting, and my question is, what do you think changes the world of entertainment? Do you think that that is a result of activism, or do you think that is a result of capitalism and commerce?
Why does it change? Like, why is that more?
How has that happened?
I'll
tell you my theory, just to provoke
you. Tell me your theory.
I've discussed this lot with my wife about things like Ghostbusters and stuff. Ghostbusters, brilliant film. Why did they make an all-female Ghostbusters? I think because Hollywood is waking up to the fact that cinema has been aimed at men for so long, and there's a market. And if there wasn't a market, they wouldn't bother. So I'm saying your activism is pointless. The market has figured it out. Discuss.
Any kind of activism has a million different directions and tendrils, right? But I think you're right that it is a. It is a market. I absolutely agree. I've always been firmly of the belief that the market and capitalism drives an awful lot. But also it's the activism that makes those, because it's still mostly white men in like middle-aged white men in suits. The person, the client I worked with who worked in corporate mining, referred to most of the people she worked with as male, pale and stale. So I think it's those male, pale, stales in Hollywood. It's still them that make most of the decisions, you know. And you see that even when you see, I watched that teen film, The Duff, and there's a point where they start unfollowing each other on social media because they're having a fight and they're saying all these things, and you're like, that's not how Twitter works. Like, you're making a film for teens and you don't understand how teen things work because it's the male pale stales who are making all the decisions. And so I think what the activism does is wake them up to that. And I don't think it's like, you know, small scale demos. I think it's more, Kate Blanchett at the Oscars saying, wake up people, the world is round, you know, 50% of the population are women, why are we being paid so much less? But there's like a drip up effect of these things, you know. It used to be okay to be hugely homophobic, it used to be okay to be hugely misogynist,
and those things
and racist, you know, and those things begin to change because someone starts kicking and screaming about it. Like, so for example, I have one foot in this activist community in Toronto, and sometimes people say things where I'm like, oh, come on. You know, people are just whatever, triggered by something. I'm trying to think of an example. There's an example that isn't a good one, but there's someone who, like, I have some friends and they're not allowed to have they weren't allowed to have Secret Santa at their Christmas party because one girl is triggered by Christmas. Which I think is amazing. But sometimes they're, but you know what I mean? Like, people being like, you're being racist, or you're being fatphobic, or you're being whatever. And sometimes people say things and I think, oh, calm down. Secretly, I think that in my head, but my feeling is I'm glad that that is the fringe. I'm glad that you. So here's an example. Dan, do you know Dan Savage? Dan Savage, people don't know, he's an advice columnist. He's like a sex positive advice columnist. He also has a really great podcast called The Savage Lovecast. And I feel like he does so much good for the world. He's brought so much to a lot of mainstream people of things like rights for sex workers and sex positivity and and the understanding that, like, for example, women are socialized to make everything okay, so they often end up in sexual situations that they don't necessarily want to be in because they're kind of socialized to be like, oh, everything's fine, even though I didn't actually want to give you a blowjob or whatever. And so to me, Dan Savage does so much good, but some people really hate him and they like make websites being like, Dan Savage is transphobic, or he used to be accused of being biphobic, and maybe actually he was. But it's just these things where I'm like, come on, like, Dan Savage does so much more good than harm. But I'm glad that that is the fringe, that it's someone telling Dan Savage off for, I don't know, using a certain, for going like, vaginas are gross, ew. Is a thing.
I agree. Because it's a bit like music.
And it means the boundary isn't, you know, whatever, you're a woman, you're terrible, and you're stupid. And
I used to describe it as the nipple effect, to bring it back to sex positivity, which is that in music, that you have pop on the nipple, mm-hmm. and you have indie music on the boob, and as we could easily use a dartboard rather than a tit, but it seemed opposite. And without the fringe, you wouldn't get the you wouldn't get the activity in the middle, and it needs to, like, Elbow was once on that fringe, and then suddenly you started hearing a Coldplay song that sounded a little like an Elbow song, and those guys are influenced by the things going on the edge, and then Elbow makes their way to the middle, and somebody else takes up the fringe, Skrillex takes up the fringe, and then a load of pop music sounds like Skrillex, and I feel like it's mostly the same with activism. My sister's an academic and does fat study stuff, social geography around body image, and particularly.
Oh, awesome.
I mean, essentially, being fat is really the last big sort of witch hunt that exists, really, that people just still don't think about.
Exists.
Yes, totally.
Well, but people think it's totally okay to
to have a go at fat people. Yeah. And sometimes I get frustrated with her world because it's very shy about talking and in the media and about doing things in public. And I'm like, if you don't, people won't change their mind. And then there's a fear about being criticised, you know. Well, people will say horrible things if we do that. Well, let them fucking say it. And I want to go, as you know, it's easy, having spent 10 years on the radio, to go, oh, someone says a bad thing, don't let it bother you. So sometimes I want more academic interference and publicity and white noise from that world, I suppose. But then there's trends that exist, and I cannot go a day, for the last year at least, I cannot go a day without my type being referred to as white male, and it really pisses me off because
give me an example.
Of every day in the last year, I can't think of one now. Let me think. ones that I can actually talk about. There's definitely opportunities in work that have been scuppered as a result of me being a white man.
Like the John Holmes thing, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I only saw the headline of John Holmes, but John Holmes
got let go from the Now show, having been there for 18 years, and BBC say it wasn't, but he says it was, that it was because they want to get more diverse people, and he was basically saying, but I understand that it's good to have diversity, but, you know, why let me go when I'm good and I've been doing well? And I feel like that's how you have to create change. Like, you can't just be like, let's just base it on talent, because
I agree with that.
Decisions are male, pale, and stale, and so you have to, like, put some people.
I don't know enough. But I think to draw the line. There is a line that's been drawn that is to do with male, female, or at least a circle around white men that goes, you've had it good for thousands of years, now you've got to take it for a bit.
I think that's totally fair enough.
I don't think I think that you, being born in... Where were you born?
I was born in London.
The South. And you probably had a better education than me. You don't sound northern. You've been around London, you have had way more opportunity than I have as a
You're discounting what it's like to move through the world. Okay, so I interviewed Josie Long for the X-Men podcast, and actually this is in the comedy book that we did that came out last year, Off the Mic. And she was saying that she figured out, she was like, every single, she was saying a conservative estimate, 300 times in a year, someone has either said to me, either I've heard someone say women aren't funny, or they've said, I don't usually find women funny, but you're funny, or, you know, something about, you know, oh, comedian with tits or whatever it is. And she's like, my male counterparts haven't had that. And so I can't remember how many years she'd been in comedy, but she did the maths and was basically like, you know, this many hundreds of times or thousands of times I've had to have that be said to me or said around me, and to respond to that, and that's going to affect me, and my male counterparts haven't had. And I understand, like, I agree with you that I have privilege for having a posh voice, for being middle class, for being in a position where I was able to do some work experience for free when I first started out, which not everyone can, and there is privilege there. But I also have walked through the world as a woman and had this, and just the, like, gentle drip 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 drip, this is the stuff totally that I never used to see. And yeah. so that's going to affect not only the whether or not people give me chances, but also whether or not I go for those chances, and then how I behave during those chances.
You know, I don't question any of that men
tend to apply for jobs they're underqualified for, and women tend to apply for jobs that they're overqualified for. And so that my thing of, like, white men, you've had it good for thousands, you know, whatever, hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah. Now it's time to take a break. It's also like, how old are you, Hal?
36.
Okay, so you're a baby, don't worry.
Shut up.
So you've had it good for 36 years, right? It's not just like...
No, not really. I personally, this is my problem, is that I have... Absolutely, is that I am put into a camp with people who I have hated my whole life. Well, I have hated.
It's not about saying you're misogynist. It's about saying that you have stepped through. So here's an example. I have a friend who...
Hang on. Well, you know that what I am saying is that I hear people refer to me, people say things offhand in the same way that Josie Lawrence has had offhand bullshit said. Josie Long has had. I don't like offhand things that are made because I am a type. Now, my type is being said to be, it is putting me into that same camp as the misogynists and the pricks. Okay, if that's
no, but you need to give me an example.
You would say that because you're a white man. I say I don't like something on TV.
Right. So here's the thing. Yes, it's fucking annoying when people say things like that. And sometimes it's bullshit, and it's not necessarily true. But I think what's important, and this is the thing that I've had to learn, and it's painful, Hal, is to stop and be like, well, actually, is that true? It's like when you were doing the box set pod the other week about the Baz Luhrmann thing, and you were saying, do you not like, you know, are you responding? And they're like, don't call me racist. And I feel like we're so taught that being a racist or being a misogynist is like the worst thing, that it has to be binary, either I'm one or the other. And that's something I've totally realized, especially with, like, doing all my work around the Black Lives Matter stuff, like, what do I need to do as a white person? And certainly as an example around race, we are really taught. I was speaking to my brother the other day, and I'd said, oh, who are you with? And he was, like, in a different country. I said, who are you with? He went, oh, these other two guys who are, oh, don't know if it's a bit racist to say black. And I was like, it's not racist to say that someone's black if they are black. But we're taught that. We're taught that talking about race in any way is racist.
Oh, I'm afraid talking about this. I am afraid talking about this because...
But also we're taught that talking about this stuff, like, we're taught that it's our right to not have to feel uncomfortable. And so we just don't. And I think one thing for me that's been really interesting and really painful has been to be like, well, hang on, maybe I am just saying that because I'm white and middle class. You know what I mean? Is to me, I don't think I am. I'm saying it because it's a firm opinion that I have come to because I'm an intelligent, smart person. But it's stopping and thinking, like, what if they were right?
I remember when we were young, I remember things that I, in hindsight, I go, that was sexist. that was a product of our environment. So, for example, I remember my brother saying, when we were teenagers, my brother saying, I don't like any bands with women as the lead singer. And he was not wrong. He didn't like any bands that had women as the lead singers. But this was before the point at which women had got to the point where they could actually have a personality as a lead singer, where they weren't just a construct of men. A bit like I've heard it for years. I have campaigned against to radio bosses about the use of women on radio. It's still like 98% of men are presenting on commercial radio, and the women who are there are a ditzy sidekick.
You know? I was told by my boss that he was like, I would never put you on. It was like some slot was coming up, and he said, I would never put you on there because I'd never have two women next to each other on the schedule.
Yeah, well,
too many vaginas.
Well, here's my problem, right, is that I think sometimes things go mainstream. Activism sometimes goes mainstream, and people start using it in a way that really pisses me off. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm saying all publicity is great for a great cause, but for example, Jamie and I, in the last 2 or 3 years of our career, if you like, our entire career, we never heard the end of, you know, you don't have two men together on the radio. It won't work. Having two blokes together won't work. Now, that is the same conversation as two women, because it's saying that it's a different problem. It's the radio is reductive. Now, does it happen to be white men who are the ones being reductive? Yeah. So changing that might help.
But I think that's the thing, is I think when you're saying it's the same conversation, it's not the same conversation because of the context and the connotation around it. So when you say people are being racist against, you know, not that you would say this ever, Hal, because you're much more evolved, but anyone being like, oh, they're being racist against white people, it's not possible because white people have never been the oppressed ones in that context between black and white people. And so it's not the exact same conversation, but I hear what you're saying. And the other thing is, like, I hear what you're saying. Sometimes people are going to say to you, that's because you're a white, straight, able-bodied man. And it's not. But I feel like that's what happens when something goes mainstream. But if that's the price that has to be paid, then it's a pretty small price. Like, you're still going to get to move through the world, as my friend Rick says, playing the computer game of life on its easiest setting.
But it needs to be argued back against, because if you were talking physics in this, it's the same as, like, I remember my dad talking about, and really I'm talking physics now, I'm talking patterns, all right, I'm not talking about comparing oppressed here. I remember my dad saying when sort of Islamic fundamentalism started to be on the rise, we were talking about, there was a debate in the press about women being allowed to wear headscarves and hijabs and stuff, wasn't there? Do you remember that? And I remember my dad saying, do you know what? This is part of what comes when something like this happens. Just like in the 80s, if you were Irish, if you had an Irish accent and you were on the tube or you were on public transport, Irish people everywhere would get looked at funny because of the IRA in the 80s. And it's almost like this is part of, if you were to look at the physics, part of the cloud affecting this. And that is an incredibly negative thing. I understand that this is a positive thing. And by the way, me and Jamie not being allowed to be two men is also sexist against women, because it's saying you need a ditzy woman on the show as well. But when I hear people very easily write things off that is based on one line, it really annoys me, because I go, actually, solving the BBC's problems of sex by employing 70% extra women in radio is going to do a great thing for women in radio. However, the women that I hear employed there come from the problem area that the BBC has had for 50 years, which is that they're all publicly educated Southern people who are being employed. And that is,
but it's also,
as
but
much
it's also,
of a problem.
It's not about, it's so certainly in media, it's not about who gets the jobs. It's about the perception, and it's about the, like, just like one of the things, you know, with Barack Obama, I had a lot of problems with him. He loved to kill people. He promised no more nuclear weapons and then built more than any other president. And but it's the perception, the visual of like a black president means that every kid growing up is like, oh, like every black kid growing up is like, that is a job that I could have. You know, again, with Hillary, who I think is a terrible warmonger. I am not a fan of hers at all. Not to say that I'm glad Trump got in, because Jesus. But I was aware, assuming that she would get in like everyone else did, I was like, from a perception point of view, it's going to be great being like, look, women, you can be the ruler of the biggest, the quote unquote most powerful country in the whole world. And so I think with media, like, I totally agree that certainly that is another big problem that they need to deal with, is everyone being totally middle class and friends with everyone else. But in terms of perception, I do think it's very important. And I do think that that's hugely important in the media. And same with Mona, right? Like, it's so important for them to have.
Yeah, but it's more important that it's good. Like, it is more important that it's good. No one will watch it if it's shit.
Yeah. But it's...
No, actually, it's not more important. It's equally as important that something that is good is a result of, and I would say this is true of Barack Obama, there's no positive discrimination going on there. This was a guy who was phenomenal and black who became president. And I don't think we'll see somebody as qualified as him from the roots up. I think we're going to have, you know, that's another conversation about the Trump types, you know.
Can I tell you something? Sorry, you finish what you're saying.
We need to finish in like 3 minutes.
I have something so interesting to tell you.
I'm going to definitely listen to you. I want to say this. I do not feel like a minority. I do not feel like I'm being picked on. What I really hate sometimes is when the public latch onto something and it makes them feel good. It makes them feel like they're ticking an activist box, right? Like when they grab onto 5 fruit and veg a day, they feel like they're doing something good in the world in that particular area. It is bollocks. It's made up on bollocks. Now, being able to point out white men have been a problem for many years is one thing, but it also discounts so much about our mothers, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, of how they got here, how they chose to go through life in the way that they chose. And I recommend to anybody to watch the Gilmore Girls, because the new episodes of the Gilmore Girls it's a type of feminism that never talks about it, the fact that it's feminist, and it's my type of activism is where you go. So all I'm saying is, if we're going to start drawing lines about fairness, I am really glad that finally men are being misogynist people, including women and men, are being taken on by the world at the moment.
It's not about misogynist people. It's about culture, which you can be in and be part of, and I have been in and been part of, and be contributing to without realizing it. That's the problem. Like, that's the problem with when you're a white person, you're like, oh, I'm fine because I never use the N-word, but you don't realize the little drip, drip, drip of racism that you might be doing. And I feel like that's the, and like, yes, it's annoying when people latch onto things and start being like, oh, you're just being a white man, just kind of knee-jerkly without thinking it through. But if the net result is people are waking up to privilege and starting to be aware and more careful, then
yeah, that's good. A wise old person said to me the other day something really interesting, which was we all got here. Like the culture you're talking about, the culture which bred misogyny and allowed misogyny, was everybody's responsibility, just the white man. And I'm annoyed at the moment because it feels like whether people live their lives as fair-minded activist people, I am blamed for something that I didn't do.
I agree with you. We're all complicit in it, and we're all complicit just even in misogyny things. You know, that's a big thing for me, that of kind of waking up to this stuff. When I used to get wolf whistled on the street, that I would be like, oh yeah, thanks. And now I'm like, fuck you, I am not an object. But I'm still aware, you know, but just those little things that I would say and do things that were contributing to all of that. I would like really flirt with people if it would get my student radio station ahead in radio. I never did it just myself because I had felt icky about that. But totally, I would do that. Deborah Frances White, who I wrote the book with, the comedy book, Off the Mic. available. Yeah. With has a really funny bit in her show where she talks about walking down the street and being wolf whistled and being like, "Fuck you, still got it," you know, and then being wolf whistled another time and turning around to be angry and realizing that he's instead catcalling a younger, thinner lady behind her, and she's like simultaneously furious on her behalf and crushed. And they now, her and Sophie Hagen now do an amazing podcast called The Guilty Feminist, which is kind of based on the principles of all of those things. But yeah, absolutely. Okay, so
I see, whereas I have never in my life thought anything other than anyone who wolf whistles is rude.
This is the crux, that it's like where
I want it to get to.
And it's not just the white men who are the bad guys. Like, yeah, all of us. But
I want to stop people being horrible to other people. That's where I want the line to be drawn, without having to say this was your fault, or I presume this was your fault. It's like, I wasn't alive. I've been as much part of it as my wife has up until this point, because I genuinely have been brought up in a way by my parents which says to be rude or to...
Yeah, but the problem is not just about using the N-word or catcalling someone, that the problem is more the little drip, drip, drip things that happen. Even stuff like, I was out for lunch with a bunch of mostly white dudes, all quite alpha, and then I started talking and one of them talked over me. And then, because I'm socialized to make everything okay, I just stopped. And I was so cross with myself afterwards. But that's the thing that happens all the time.
Yeah, but that's because talk so much.
No, but this is the thing that happens.
Marcia,
I
went and opened the back door, let my rabbit in, made myself a cup of tea, sat down again while you'd said one sentence. And that's true.
But still, if you interrupted me, Hal, you would be aware of it and apologise for it. But this guy didn't, and I'm sure I've done it. And this, I've noticed even more. So I have a friend who lives in Detroit and does a lot of activism there. And I remember him telling me, I need to be careful when I'm in meetings, because I'm aware that as a white, straight, able-bodied man, I have walked through life with people backing down and listening to me. And I'm used to, and when he said that to me, I started keeping an eye on myself. And I noticed, particularly with two friends of mine who are women of colour, one of whom is like really like, I'm just stuttering because I'm like, should I be talking about this on a podcast? But I just noticed basically that I would, because I interrupt a lot, but that they and other women that I speak to will just stop talking immediately. And I'm like, from this Shark Tank background where like you snooze, you lose, you just jump in with conversation. But actually I've started to be aware of like being used to people backing down. Just like this guy who I was at lunch with, who's a super nice dude, but he's used to just talking and people listening to him. And so he didn't even hear that I had started talking, because I don't know, for whatever reason. And nobody went, oh, hang on, Marcia had started a completely different sentence, because I just shut up and stopped. Whereas I think the only way for me to have carried on was just to literally keep talking and then to have to turn to him and be like, I started before you. But it happens all the time. And so that's the kind of thing. And that's not about him catcalling me or being misogynist or being, you know, that's the little drip, drip, drip that we don't notice, which, as I say, I have been complicit in. I'm sure I've done that. It's that you can't think that this is the problem. Is if we think that racism or misogyny is using the N-word or whatever, calling a woman a slag or being overt, then we can all walk around being like, oh well, I never do that, so that's totally fine, so I never have to think about this.
Wait there. In fact, we have to finish. My piano lesson is here. I'm teaching a piano lesson. One thing I will just say is that my point is that potentially the trend is for that guy to be as wonderful and thinking to say that I need to stop cutting people off. Your friend who didn't cut someone off because I'm a white, able-bodied man. I have been in so many groups of different types of people. I went to drama school, for God's sake. I am used to everybody, regardless of sex, interrupting each other and competing in a bum fight. And that's my experience of the world. Now, I don't know whether that's because you are a woman or whether that's because he's a dick.
He's not. And I think your experience in drama school is somewhat exceptional, because people do tend to be, you know, us showboats tend to be a bit mouthier.
Yeah.
But no, I know this guy. He's not a dick. He's a really nice guy. He just moves through the world in so let me tell you another Deborah Frances White thing to explain this brilliantly. So she talked about in the same show, she talked about how when she first moved to London from Australia, everybody said, oh my god, driving in London is a nightmare. And she was an au pair and she would drive the family's Volvo, and she was like, driving in London is lovely, everyone is so nice to me, like everybody gets out of the way when I need to come by and everyone's lovely. And then a few months later she drove her boyfriend's Honda Civic and suddenly was like, oh my god, everyone on the streets of London lost their mind. And he turned to her and said, you have to stop driving like you're driving a Volvo. And because, and it wasn't that people were so polite, it's that everyone was just getting out of her way because she was in the big car. And that's what it's like when you move through the world with privilege, is you just think, oh, everyone's so polite, oh, I can just talk whenever, you know, people tend to listen when I talk because I'm the smartest person in the room.
Richard Hammond wrote an article which was the exact opposite, which was that when he had to drive his wife's Fiat Panda into town, and he had to pull over almost in tears because he was cut off and bullied so much. Mm-hmm. So
there you go. That's what privilege is. It's because anyway, you're not aware of it.
Listen,
and so now this is what we're doing. How we're waking up to it.
My neighbour Nikki is sitting here waiting for a piano lesson.
Sorry, Nikki.
So that she can learn to be as talented as you. So I'm going to go. Thank you. This has been, I knew it would turn into a can of worms. We'll continue it another time.
That was really fun.
Thank you, Marcia. And thanks, see you next week when Jamie will return. He has had a baby, or should I say, he inseminated a woman who gave birth. And that child is now 2 weeks old, and he can tell us about that next week. And
very excited.
Thank you, Marsh.
Bye.
See you later.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.